This is Poured Over, a show about stories presented by the booksellers of Barnes & Noble.
I'm Miwa Messer. I'm the producer and host of Poured Over. And, you know, I am not sentimental by nature. I'm not nostalgic by nature. I will say, though, reading Brad Gooch's biography of Keith Haring, Radiant, The Life and Line of Keith Haring, did make me a little wistful for New York that really just lives in our memories at this point. But, Brad, it's such a treat to meet you. I have been reading you since your Frank O'Hara biography, City Poet, so I may have just dated myself. But I'm so excited to have this conversation.
Maybe you're a 90s person.
Well, here's the thing. When did you start working on this? Because it sounds like you were working on it during the pandemic.
I was, yes, which was very interesting. I mean, it also changed biography writing for me, because instead of taking people to lunch and dinner, everyone was on Zoom. It was kind of nice. It also gave me more time to write. So it was a plus.
You've also written biographies of Rumi and Flannery O'Connor. I mean, I think of you as sort of a literary biographer first. And you have done other, there's a memoir of your early life in New York. There's a poetry collection. There's a story collection. There's some books about spirituality. I mean, this is not your first project, but I feel like it's the really perfect pairing of biographer and subject. And it speaks to a lot of different parts of your life as well as Haring's.
Yeah.
Can we talk about that for a second?
With biography, I always think a lot before I start because, you know, it goes on for a long time. This book took 6 years to write. And so it has to be an idea I've had for a while. And I basically had this idea of writing something about Keith Haring since the 1980s when I would intersect with him at certain points. And I was thinking of it then as a novel. Mm-hmm. And I did his artwork around, and he would come in and out of my life. When it came time to actually, that I had space to write that novel, then I thought, I don't really like novels about famous artists. And and also the kind of Guinness Book of Records facts of Keith's life are so astonishing. I mean, this comet of 10 years that he had when he went from being this kid on the streets of the East Village to a global art star are amazing, and the amount of work he did.
I love that you use comet to describe him, because I have a note to myself after reading the book saying space race baby, that Keith Haring was a space race baby. I mean, he was raised on television as a new thing, sitcoms, I Dream of Jeannie, The Beatles, Life magazine, Look magazine. Like, he's really a product of that sort of American peak monoculture kind of thing, right? And yet he turns everything inside out.
I mean, again, personal connections with Keith. I'm from Pennsylvania.
Right.
He was 6 years younger than I was, but I well understood the television agenda. I well understood the conservative parents and his phases where he goes through his Jesus freak and a monkey's band and a deadhead. I mean, all of this is very lively. And just now, something that you would write about in someone's biography, I think.
And that's the thing. The monkey stuff was new to me. The Jesus freak stuff was really new to me. The deadhead stuff. I mean, I just always thought of him as this sort of quintessential downtown guy, right? Like, when I was in college, we all had, you know, the silence equals death posters. We all had whatever pieces of Haring, you know, and it's right next to the Smiths poster and that Duano kiss photograph that, like, literally you were not allowed to go to college without that poster on your wall at a certain period in the 90s. And he was so much a part of our experience of the world. I mean, there he was on MTV, there he was on the subway, like, he felt accessible, even though, of course, Tony Shafrazi is showing his work. Like, as you said, he's a global art superstar. But for college kids and teenagers and young people in their 20s, like, he still felt like we could be part of that energy and that excitement, and that it wasn't just for adults.
And he was aware of it. I mean, his bumper sticker concept was art for everybody. And he really, from doing these 5,000 drawings on the subway system and beyond, he was always trying to bring people in to the art world and into that experience. And it was at a time when it had been the opposite. I mean, it was kind of elite and conceptual, and he really opened it up. So he wanted you to feel the way you were feeling.
He was so ahead of his time. That's how it felt for me.
Right. I mean, I talked to, and it's at the end of my book, Ann Temkin, who's the curator of painting and sculpture at MoMA. She kind of apologized for the institution to me. I mean, that MoMA never showed him when he was, they never bought any work of his. And she said, well, with some radical art, there's like a 30-year time period.
Right.
An alarm clock goes off. I mean, it happened with the water lilies. It happened with the Abex painters. And you know, she was saying that Keith Haring is just about at that 30-year mark where we can see his work as lasting.
And I was one of the fortunate people who got to see the show that the Broad put on in Los Angeles called Keith Haring Art is for Everyone. And it was electric walking through that space. And again, like my experience of Haring originally when I was younger and very, very impressionable was, you know, t-shirts and posters and postcards and MTV and, you know, 30-second ads kind of thing, right? Like, or pins or buttons. It was very sort of free moving on the street. And to see these huge, I mean, some of these paintings are like 40 feet long.
Right.
And 20 feet high. And I think I didn't understand the scope of the work because when you see it reproduced on the page or the screen, like you just, right. You don't, unless you see him working on the piece, you just don't understand how physically huge some of these pieces were. And some of them are painted on tarps and some are on canvas, but he really started on paper, right?
Right. And he always favored paper. Uh-huh. I mean, the canvas was too arty, you know, sort of classic artist, and that it intimidated him and it was too expensive. So when Tony Shafrazi, his dealer, kept encouraging him, of course, oh, well, do paintings. Then he found tarp, which is what this plastic they were covering construction sites with, and then did all these paintings on tarp. So he was always trying to get around the traditional art world and also those kind of speak that language at the same time. But I had the same experience as you, even in the middle of writing this book. I went to the show at the Tate in Liverpool. And it was really the first time, you know, you saw this Haring work on a museum wall. It wasn't necessarily in a big party scene. They weren't playing a lot of 80s music. And
right.
Then you saw that it's communicating to you in kind of a big way. And that's when I realized also that he was, you know, here in an enduring way and that people didn't realize it at the time. Because he treated it so lightly.
I think, too, there were people who mistook sort of, all right, we all referred to it as dancing babies, right? Dancing babies, barking dogs, the spaceships, all of that kind of thing. There were people who just saw the playfulness first. But if you see a lot of the larger scale works, they're really angry. They're
right.
Really, like, the rage just radiates off of them. Like, there was a lot more happening with him than you saw on the walls of the Pop Shop.
Right.
And certainly MTV. Like, I know I keep coming back to MTV, but that was like a groundbreaking thing, right? Between the music and the fashion and everything. Like, that was a moment, even though there was lots of stuff going off the rails across the country. I mean, just, and AIDS was really starting. It was bad. It was really bad. But the idea that you had fashion and music and art all feeding into one place. I mean, music videos now, you know, you pretty much just shoot them on the phone. But back in the day, they used to be treated like mini movies. Like, you had real budgets and you took weeks and weeks and weeks to shoot them and you hired fancy directors and all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. And Keith was on MTV.
Yeah, absolutely.
Duran, painting. Mm-hmm. That's where he wanted to be. But you're right. I always think that he's sort of the opposite of Andy Warhol, where he was taking these kind of silly topics like soup can and treating it very seriously. Keith took these very serious topics like nuclear proliferation, environmentalism, AIDS, and he treats them in these bright colors, with these kind of cartoon characters jumping around, and it seduces you into this subject matter, which is often pretty serious.
I thought it was also really subversive, too, that he never really titled individual pieces.
Yeah.
And because he was like, yeah, I don't actually have to name it, but he's also really good at naming them.
Right. Well, he was also a poet.
Yeah. Okay.
He had a whole poet period.
Yeah.
He came to New York. And I always thought of him in that setting. I mean, poetry was like a leading art in New York in the 1970s downtown, along with rock music. And you can tell, and it shows in Keith's titles, and it shows in his his attitude, I think, towards art.
There's one piece that includes, it's painted on the piece itself, and I'm not going to say the name of the piece only because I don't want to get it wrong, but The Message Is the Message is painted in it. And, you know, obviously it's a playoff of Marshall McLuhan, The Medium Is the Message. And Keith was like, yeah, no, actually it is. And that always sort of stuck with me. And now it's just like, oh God, this guy was so prescient and really ahead of his time in so many ways.
Yeah.
And here he is, and you see these photos of him with his giant glasses and, you know, his sort of scrubby hair and his t-shirts and his sneakers. And he's very much sort of proto hip hop culture kid. And he's pulling, you know, from Fab Five Freddy and the whole hip hop scene, and the graffiti scene in New York wild style is taking off at this point. Like, it's this perfect storm,
right,
of the city building on itself, right?
Again, with the sort of Warhol contract, mm-hmm. interviewed Sean Lennon. You know, Keith had these really strong friendships with kids, yeah. And Sean Lennon was about 9. But he was saying to me, you know, at the time, Andy Warhol was also hanging out with his mother. You know, was very kind of had a kind of chic style, and also his work wasn't really comprehensible to a 9-year-old, the meaning of it. Whereas Keith, I mean, he said his style with the sneakers and things was what everyone was wearing at middle school. Mm-hmm. And the work, you know, with these cartoon characters, right. And it just was made for him. So kids were one of these audiences, mm-hmm. that he spoke to. I mean, speaking to many at once,
yeah.
That was one of them.
But you tell a great story too in the book, in Radiant, where Keith goes to Iowa. Because an art teacher just wrote to him and said, hey, my student, I'm teaching you to my tiny people. It's middle school. And he's like, yeah, I'll go. And he gets on a plane and goes and teaches an art class to little kids in Iowa. And he sort of does it in a way that his dad got him to sort of think about his work when he was tiny. He would just draw a circle and have the kids expand on it. Or he'd draw a squiggly line and have the kids expand on it. And I think that's such a great way to teach, mm-hmm. art, because you just end up making a thing. But if you're starting out, it's a really great way to feel like you get what's happening, right? It's not like draw that vase or draw that apple, but like any kid can make a squiggly line, right? Any one of us, not just a kid, I should say.
Which goes back to, I'm glad you brought up his dad.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in wholesome, small Kutztown, Pennsylvania,
yeah.
where he was from, he's from a Marine family. His father was a Marine, and yet his father was also an amateur cartoonist. And besides the influence of Walt Disney and Andy Warhol, Keith, his father, had a big influence. And part of it was this game that then passed on of you draw something and I'll draw something and we draw together. And also his father would always encourage him to draw original cartoons. So don't just mimic Mickey Mouse and Daffy, mm-hmm. Duck. And there's a way of seeing that iconic, semiotic imagery of Keats in the beginning is original cartoons and barking dogs and crawling babies that are now speak to us as Keith Haring. And I think that's part of what's enduring about him. He wasn't appropriating. He wasn't being ironic, you know, and he was trying to communicate what you said. The message was the message.
I'm also fond of a dude who's running around SVU. He went to the School of the Visual Arts in New York for not a full run, but you talk about how he gets to the school and he's using Post-its as art because they were new. And I'm like, yep, dude, after my own heart. Not that I'm making art with Post-its, but I do run my life off of Post-its. I appreciate them quite a lot. But I mean, he really is, in a lot of ways, like Basquiat, who was a peer of his, he's taking unconventional material and saying, I can turn this into art. You have to step away and stop thinking. Like, I grew up in a place where, you know, art had to be thousands of years old or hundreds of years old, and it had to look a certain way, and no one was ever going to hang a Haring. Now, obviously, the art scene has changed quite a lot in Boston and other parts of New England, but when I was growing up, there's no way a guy like Keith Haring is getting into any, you know, quote-unquote legitimate, and I'm using air quotes, art space. And the critics also gave him a really hard time here in New York.
Yeah, it's really brutal to read some of these reviews from, mm-hmm. The thing that really triggered them was the Pop Shop. I mean, Warhol had been playing around with art business, he called it. Then Keith starts a store, and no one no artist of his generation or before had started a store. And he starts selling at price points these kids could buy and everyone could buy t-shirts that were prints and pins and all, you know, all of this. But this act, you know, of mixing commerce and high art, the high and the low, really bothered people. I mean, Robert Hughes was the critic for
so mean.
And I'm in the yeah, he would call him Keith Boring and John Michelle Basket Case and talked about him as a disco decorator. Mm. So there's also like a shading of homophobia.
Right, of course.
You know, a lot of this criticism at the time. But if you take them one after another, the attacks were quite intense. And Keith either was insulated from this or escaped from it because in Europe, as has been the case with other American poets and painters, he was being taken more seriously than he was in America. So his lifetime, he was never shown at a museum in the United States, but he was shown at the Bordeaux in the south of France, at the Pompidou in Paris, at the Stedelijk in Amsterdam. So he was seen closer to the way that he was seeing himself in Europe. I mean, he was taken seriously.
And he really was a global thinker, though. I mean, he was pushing the envelope on high, you know, that whole artificial high versus low. I mean, one of the things I love most about Margot Jefferson, who was a longtime critic for the New York Times, she always did that high-low. She was like, you can pretend that this is high. She just wrote what she wanted to write. And it was always really fantastic because I always felt like I was going to learn something new from her because of the way she approached all of the things criticism could do. Mm-hmm. Right. Or the way she wrote about dance, or she'd write about a movie or write about a book. And she's just throwing in whatever reference she felt like. And it all made sense. And I kind of feel like that with Keith, because obviously music is a huge piece of this. Like, you're writing about the Mud Club area and the Palladium and all of these places. Paradise Garage, which I had not thought about in 8 million years. Like, all of these places, though, where the culture is being built in New York, and it's being built by Black and brown and queer people. And in a way that, I mean, real estate being what it is, it's harder for these spaces to exist, right? Like, Limelight is a mall now. I mean, granted, Limelight was Limelight, but it's a mall.
Right. No, I mean, Keith definitely mixed all of those things together, and he was definitely in the forefront of that. And now it seems, I mean, people were so upset that he sold anything. I mean, now we have licensing, certainly of Keith Haring stuff. So you go to the playground and these kids are in Keith Haring. Sometimes pullovers that just have his signature on them can be a lot. But you know that. But all this is now part of what artists do. I mean, there's a younger generation that keyed in to Keith Haring, and that's why he can make sense to us now. And at the time, seemed like a complete outsider.
Well, I also want to put him in a tiny bit of context. I mean, his peers include Cindy Sherman, mm-hmm. Kenny Scharf, Jenny Holzer, Barbara Kruger, whose work I also love. Like, I mean, he's coming up at a period where lots of folks are challenging what the idea of art looks like. And, you know, Jenny Holzer hangs in museums now, and Barbara Kruger, actually the Broad in Los Angeles, owns a couple of Holzers and a couple of Krugers that are standouts. I mean, they own some Basquiat's as well that are pretty standout as well. It's a nice collection.
A good early collector. And I mean, that's why, why they have that collection. Where someplace like the Museum of Modern Art collected nothing, therefore they don't have much. They have that one great 30-foot long drawing that they brought out for the reopening of the museum, but that was given to them by the foundation. So it helps follow the collectors. I mean, you know, that way.
It is follow the collectors, but I did not know. There's a tiny bit of a backstory, though, with MoMA that isn't just being a little snotty about what's high and what's low. And I'm kind of laughing because I did not know this story until you tell it in Radiant. Tony Shafrazi may have done a thing at MoMA. I'm going to ask you to tell the story. Tony may have done a thing at MoMA with Guernica, the very famous Picasso painting, and a can of red spray paint. I can understand MoMA being mad about that piece, but at some point you kind of have to get over it because Shafrazi obviously has gone on to be that guy who is the gallerist for so many major artists, but he did a thing. Would you tell that story?
It's very interesting. I remember it. I mean, because it was supposedly a Vietnam War protest, went to Guernica and spray painted Kill Lies All, maybe nervous because he wanted to say Kill All Lies, but said he to bring it back into the conversation. It's a great anti-war statement. For this, he was never allowed in the Museum of Modern Art. And that, you know, the word on the street was that that the reason they wouldn't buy any work by any artist who was represented by Shafrazi. And Keith didn't like the idea that he had spray painted Guernica. He loved the cop. But it is interesting that his dealer is, again, this kind of outsider guy. I mean, there's something edgy about Tony at that time.
And Keith had been his own dealer before Tony starts representing him. And at this point, too, like the Soho gallery, I mean, obviously Soho in New York now is not what it was at the time, but when the gallery scene was Soho and Soho was the gallery scene, it was a really different world. And here's Shafrazi going, I have this guy.
Right.
And suddenly, like, everything's kind of changing. And again, like, Keith is sort of blowing up the established order. I mean, yes, he has help from, but it's like Shafrazi in a garage with someone else going, yeah, we're just going to make a thing.
Right. I remember Diego Cortez described Our World Then to me as like white people in white boxes drinking white wine. And that was, whereas the Shafrazi kind of garage, open garage kind of gallery was something else. And but Keith, again, he hadn't wanted that. That he consciously, unconsciously got around this was the Subway art project.
Right. Chalk Man.
Yeah. No one knew who he was, but yep. Some New York Post, they called him Chalk Man. Someone started drawing these drawings on the New York City subway on these blank advertising spaces that will be covered over within a week or two. And this eventually becomes 5,000 of these over 5 years. I mean, it's one of the largest public art projects ever pulled off. And one thing that happens is the millions of people who go through the subway system every day, a number of them will get hooked on these drawings and who's doing them, or he would do them as performance and then people would watch him do this. And then he started giving out pins. So by the time he had his first one-man show, Shafrazi Gallery, he already had an audience.
Right.
And brought this new audience into the gallery system.
And I think that performance piece is really important. He is not a performance artist. Like, I need to be clear about that. He's not, you know, he's just not a performance artist, but he was doing sort of early video art. One of the pieces he does at SVU, which I would really, really like to see someday, is a piece sort of about his childhood and about his dad. And I don't know if it's been displayed anywhere. I don't think it was part of the show at the Broad, right?
No, I think we might show it. We're going to do a thing at Metrograph.
Oh, cool. Okay.
We're going to show things that haven't been shown.
And okay.
That might be one of those.
Okay, because the way you describe it, I really, really want to see it. But I do, there's this piece, this legendary piece that Keith did with the choreographer Bill T. Jones.
Okay.
And you did an event. I am actually going to plug someone else's video. But you did an event in Los Angeles with Bill T. Jones for the Keith Haring exhibit that was at the Broad. It's really good. It's on their website. Go find it if you haven't seen it. It is a fabulous conversation. I would like to hang out with Bill T. Jones all the time because he is one of the smartest, sharpest dudes out there. And you asked all the right questions and the audience asked all the right questions, but the energy was great. But legendarily, Keith painted him.
Mm-hmm. Right. And
well, painted Bill. Not just Bill as a painting, which he's also done, but he also used Bill as a canvas.
I mean, first he painted when they first met at the kitchen behind Bill while Bill was dancing. So it was a collaboration in that way. Then he paints Bill's body, which he then also does to Grace Jones
a little
bit later. And the footage of that, of him painting Bill T. And when you're thinking about all the different surfaces that he works on, and one is body painting.
But that video too, that was the first, when you guys showed it at the conversation at the Broad, that was the first time I'd seen it. Because there's no soundtrack to it other than the sounds of Keith literally painting and Bill dancing. There's no music, there's no anything. It is just these two dudes very, very focused on what they're doing. And it's amazing. It is, I sort of feel like he would have done more video art. I feel like Herring would have evolved. Like, it felt like a thing that he would have gravitated towards had he lived longer. I mean, he died in 1990.
I mean, he did early on. So if you look at what he was doing at SVA when he was not painting.
Right.
I mean, and if you look at his class list, you get a sense of his temperament as well as the temperament of the time. So he's taking video, semiotics, performance art with some conceptual art with Joseph Kosuth. So it was that kind of time. And Keith very interested in videotape. Also his biographer. Now, treating someone from the 80s, all of a sudden video was this thing. So you have all of this. I mean, now we're completely covered with selfies, but with writing about Frank O'Hara in the 50s and 60s, you didn't have this kind of coverage that you have with video. Keith loved video and he loved Polaroid and all of this. So it helps. But, you know, it would lead to social media and Keith. I mean, this is a sort of, you know, he was doing social media early on, and they all were in a way. I mean, there are all these urgent messages that were being sent on the street. And all these artists that you mentioned before were all working on the street, communicating to each other. And Jenny Holzer was doing political statements, and Basquiat was doing crowns and shadows and cars. It's very exciting.
You can do a lot with a can of paint or a magic marker or a sticker.
Right.
I mean, it felt very guerrilla, very fresh, very sort of, well, you saw your first Herring in 1980, right? In the West Village?
Yeah, I saw
it. You've never forgotten it.
No. I mean, because I took it personally. I was walking from the West Village to the East Village with my lover, Howard Brookjer, was a filmmaker. Right. And, you know, stamped in graphite on the street was Clones Go Home. With this fake organization, Fags Against Facial Hair, which Keith had started. And it was like an inside joke in the gay community that the West Village was filled with clones who had beards and black leather jackets and a motorcycle look. And the East Village was this hipper, younger artist kind of thing. And, you know, that's what it was. But that, you know, that I took it personally. Howard said to me, you should go home. You have to go home now. And then I would see, I mean, and then I remember seeing on either Prince or Spring on a newsstand over several weeks, I mean, these crawling movies. So you would intersect with this art. It was exciting. And the anonymity of it at the time, that was part of the guerrilla aspect. I mean, you didn't know who Samo was. You didn't know who these people were. It was the opposite of making a name.
And one half of Samo was Jean-Michel Basquiat. And I mean, they met at SVU. You tell the story of Keith getting Jean-Michel in, and he's running around doing his graffiti as well. And they were friendly, certainly. I mean, they were coming up at the same time, but they were also sort of blowing up the rules. I mean, there are pieces that Jean-Michel has painted on like discarded refrigerator doors. Like, he was painting on whatever he could get a hold of. And there was this sort of trajectory. And obviously he died a couple of years before Keith did, of an OD. But I can't help but think sort of what kind of work they'd both be producing and what that relationship would have looked like. Because, you know, everyone likes a little friendly rivalry. And I'm sure they did. I mean, they both thought of each other as great artists, but at the same time, they're boys of a certain age. There's a little bit of rivalry.
But I mean, I think I think of it in terms of them, and then I think that whole generation, like Robert Mapplethorpe, and these people were alive, and they were 70-year-old role models, or what would it be? I mean, the world would definitely be different.
I mean, that brings me to Keith was diagnosed with AIDS in 1988.
Right.
He goes public sort of legendarily in this Rolling Stone interview that he agonized over, because I mean, if we go back to that moment in our cultural history, AIDS was a death sentence. We didn't really know what was going on. I mean, the New York Times was reporting on it like it was a gay cancer. That was the headline for a really long time. Certainly St. Vincent's Hospital in Lower New York was sort of the epicenter of a lot of what was happening. And Keith did share his diagnosis in this Rolling Stone piece. And PWA, Public Person with AIDS, was just starting to become a thing. And it was, I mean, it was radical. It was really a rock star move on his part. And he partially didn't want to do it because he knew the price of his art would go up. And that's right. Really gruesome and gross.
No, it certainly wasn't the normal career move at that time, or personal move. I mean, rare was the obituary in the Times that admitted that someone had died of AIDS.
It was a weird.
Rock Hudson was denying having AIDS while he was publicly dying. One basically from the grave was saying he had liver cancer or pneumonia. And so for Keith to come out so openly about having AIDS was remarkable. He didn't want his art to be valued because of that. He found it to be ghoulish, which he was, but he knew the art market well enough. Also at that point, he had different ideas. He had a secret studio. He was working on great work, right? Pretty much until the end. And then he was also using his work for this AIDS messaging and doing this silence equals death painting. Mm-hmm. And also being an activist within ACT UP. Peter Staley, who was the treasurer of ACT UP, told me that he would go to Keith's studio and Keith would give him brown paper bags with like $10,000 in cash in them. And then Peter would go to the Citibank on LaGuardia Place and deposit it. And then like a third of the receipts of ACT UP in 1989 were for Keith Haring. So he was doing a tremendous amount at that time.
It's a little weird for me too, sort of as I go through my daily, that Citibank is still there. As I go through my sort of daily life, you know, hitting all of these pieces, right, where there, here's the ghost of Keith Haring, right? There's a giant mural down by where I live on a public pool, and I get to see it every time I walk by. And it's been there. It's been there for forever. I probably went up right around the time he died, I think, if not before. I don't.
Yeah, it was earlier. I mean, he painted it.
Oh, he did paint it. Okay.
And the Crack is Whack mural is back on the FDR Drive.
Yep.
So I was talking to Jeffrey Deitch and we were talking about the valuation of Keith's art. I mean, in sort of old art terms in a way. And he just said, well, this doesn't really apply to him because he wasn't a studio artist and he wasn't saying, oh, I can't do that project because I have a show coming up and I have to make work. He was also doing all of this public art. He was painting the Berlin Wall, doing a Statue of Liberty banner. So all this kind of work that was part of his statement. And that's not something you can hang on a wall and auction off.
I honestly get giddy thinking about just the body of work that he was able to produce in 10 years.
Well, 10,000 works.
I mean, that's
5,000 subway, but yeah.
Right. But still, it's not nothing. And the dude did still sleep and have a life. Although it sounds like from you that he knew how to dance and Bill Cunningham made it sound like maybe he couldn't. So I'm kind of laughing about that.
There's debates about that.
Okay. But the point is, the man had a life right. In addition. I mean, he fed off of the energy of the city and the culture. I mean, there was this moment in New York, right, where serendipity ruled everything. And I'm thinking of what I can remember being young in the city at the time, but like you never knew who you were going to bump into or where you would end up or like where the night would take you, right? Like it was wild.
I mean, I partly wanted to also tell the story of that time.
You did.
And one reason Keith had always been in my brain was the you can do that through him. Mm-hmm. True, Frank O'Hara, true, too.
Yeah, yeah.
They were both public. I mean, O'Hara wasn't your traditional poet in his garret. I mean, he was very involved in social life and parties, and Keith likewise. So this story immediately becomes the story of hundreds of other people and of a time.
I mean, Madonna is debuting a couple of singles at Paradise Garage, and everyone's like, yeah, okay, because they'd never heard her. And then they hear the music, and they're like, oh. I mean, this is before Time magazine is throwing Cyndi Lauper and Madonna onto its pages going, which one's going to win? Because, right. You know, apparently we can't have more than one female pop star. But
although he told me that he cluelessly said, who is that when she was singing? And then
that's funny.
He said, Andy said she's the next big thing, which she was. And also Larry Levan helped break Madonna. I mean, she was singing Like a Virgin, which hadn't been an album yet. And he helped play that in clubs like Paradise Garage, where people were actually actually dancing to this music propelled them.
Well, and Jelly Bean Martinez, who's kind of a legendary producer, he comes out of this scene as well. Mm-hmm. And he's like with Keith at Paradise Garage and everything else. So it's this moment where I'm looking back. And obviously, I was not there while this was happening. I'm just conflating my New York, you know, the New York of my youth with Keith's New York. And Brad, you have a couple of years on me. But just that idea that anything was possible.
I mean, I think the first line of my book is Keith Haring came to New York in 1978. He hit the streets. And those streets were the key to everything. I mean, you'd be walking, he and Fab Five Fred were walking down the street and saw Paradise Garage, which Fred knew about. And he takes Keith there. And Ingrid Cisci at some point said it was like Gauguin discovering Tahiti. All this stumbling into things all the time. Everything seemed to be random and seemed to be by chance. That was part of all of the energy of that time.
I'm so happy that people are discovering Haring in a new way. It was wild to read the critics on the show in Los Angeles, and they were like, well, this is a long overdue and it's very important and all this other stuff. And I'm kind of laughing to myself. I'm delighted that everyone's come to the table finally, right? I didn't know that Keith had spent any time in Pittsburgh until I read Radiant. And you were like, yeah, he always kind of leaves it out of his biography. And it's like Calder comes out of Pittsburgh. Warhol obviously famously comes out of Pittsburgh. And Keith's like, yeah, I did some time in Pittsburgh, but we're really going to talk about New York. And again, like, I know he's from Pennsylvania. I know he has this loving family that he's very fond of too, but he really feels like he's cut from whole cloth.
Right. I mean, well, that's where he is. I mean, he always had this line. I mean, he was drawing as a kid. He never really stopped drawing. His sister did a graphic comic book about the boy who couldn't stop drawing for kids. But in New York, that really, he figures out how that line becomes his signature, I think. And once he gets that, then it reflects where he is. Tony Schiaffarazzi said that Keith was a sponge. And that's really true. I mean, you can just see him moving through these moments, a kid with color TV, and it shows up in his work. And later in his life, when he's in Europe and he's in museums and getting taken seriously as an artist, you see a lot more like sort of Picasso, Leger, these influences popping up in Keith's work. So he's very much, you can feel especially then the city in the 80s in that work. Although now seem to take it out of that and find how it's still, I mean, Radiant to me is a good work for, there's something about that work that's always very light.
In addition to all of the painters you just cited as influences on Haring, I went back to Naked Lunch, the William Burroughs novel that I had not read in quite some time, because that's also a big piece. I mean, Keith was pulling from sort of Japanese ink paintings. He was pulling, obviously, from comics and Disney and Warhol. But Naked Lunch was a big deal for him. And going back, it had been a minute since I'd read it. So I have this new edition restored text. And all I want to do is finish this book right now. And I don't have the time right this second. But reading Burroughs again on the page, I totally get how this book influences Haring, but also I'm thinking, man, there's a whole generation of writers who owe a big thank you to Mr. Burroughs.
Right. With Keith, though, comes this, you see this early, earnest, serious period when he's trying to figure out his art. And this semiotics is not just a class for him. I mean, he's trying to figure out, how do I make a language? Language, and he does it. And then he sees Burroughs at the Nova convention in 78, and Burroughs' thing of cut up then becomes also a clue where if you take these images and you cut them into different patterns, they tell a different story. It's one thing if a barking dog is following two babies. It's different if two babies are crawling after a barking dog. And together, that becomes a lot of his storytelling. And there's always storytelling in his work, too, a kind of a message and a narrative that goes through. So Burroughs, I mean, surprising to me, I think, was though the depth of the connection to William Burroughs, and they even do a collaboration.
Yeah.
This is the Apocalypse work later on. Also, the relationship with Warhol was more extensive than I thought. And they really had these kind of morning after debriefings of all the gossip of the night before, you know, but also this Warhol's pop art concept is obviously a major influence on Keith. And at the same time, Warhol's benefiting from this kind of young energy of being with Haring and Basquiat. I mean, so a lot of mutual inspiration.
I mean, isn't that what art is supposed to do, right? Like art begets art?
Yeah.
In theory?
That's right.
In theory, isn't that what we're all aspiring for, even if it's on a post-it or chalked out on the subway? You know you mentioned at the top of the show that writing this book during lockdown changed how you did biography because you were on Zooms with people and whatnot. But it seems like you've really settled into, like, biography is your thing. Earlier in your career, you can see all of the different places. There's a couple of different avenues you're going down, but it really seems like biography is the thing that you're happiest pursuing on the page, it seems. Am I right about that?
I don't know. I do know that I have a kind of genre ADD, I guess. So I've done stories and novels and all these things. But biography to me is this like Gesamtkunstwerk. I mean, it's where it comes together. Because to me, it is a novel. I mean, in a way. And then it's a novel with information in it and language. You know, all of this, there's kind of space for biography. Yeah. And biography is not one thing. I mean, people, you read different biographies, they can be very different animals. So I do like being able to do everything.
I think too, the way you write this book matches the subject and the time really well. I felt like your sentences are really breezy. I mean, you're also covering the presidency of Ronald Reagan, and you're covering some really bad moments in New York's history, and you're covering some big challenges too for Haring. And yet I just couldn't put the book down. And obviously, I have an affinity for the period. I have an affinity for the artist. I have an affinity for your work. But I felt like I was hanging out with a guy who was telling me a really great story. And then I was filling in the gaps sort of from my own, you know, bopping around the neighborhood kind of thing.
No, it is a really great story. I mean, and that's what I think I was saying in the beginning. It's partly the information facts that make it that story. I mean, you can't believe that so much is happening at once. And then the breezy is also sort of by necessity. I mean, he's moving so fast. And you keep having, you have, with every paragraph, crowding in this, like, sort of pick me, like, which event you're going to actually write about and jump to the next, because there's so much going on. And how he did that is astonishing, because he was always in some way detached. I mean, even though he was the great scene maker. He knew exactly what he was doing, and he was following his work, and he was very, very work positive. I mean, in a way that Basquiat was and Warhol was also. I mean, kind of working all the time. So you have that sort of through line, but the momentum of it, and then when you get to when he's diagnosed as HIV positive, the momentum increases. Mm-hmm. He doesn't melt away. He creates more and more and more art and goes to more and more and more places. And he's very aware of what he's doing. And even, I think, he talks about when he was doing kids' art, which he does a lot, and he was doing it at a hospital, mural. There was an interview with him where he talks about that these drawings for kids, I mean, it's not just that they're fun and distracting, but there's something healing about art and that can change you. You know, and I think that Keith had this sense of that it was keeping him alive in some way, and to sort of keep working in that way.
And the Haring Foundation made their entire archive available to you.
They did.
And you had seven years with the archive? I mean, and according to you, Keith saved everything. The dude knew. He saved everything.
Right. So he has bio preparedness.
Yeah, okay.
Habits and people don't. You know, he was very aware of what he was doing.
Well, having read Radiant, I'm very grateful that he saved everything. But for you as the biographer, though, how do you know when you're on the right path and you're not suddenly saying, oh, well, that looks shiny and new, I'm going to go that way, and it turns out to be a dead end? Like, how do you have the discipline, especially with someone like Herring, who has every piece of paper he ever, like every idea, I'm sure there is a lot of post-it notes in a file somewhere. Like, how do you know you found the actual spine of the story?
Yeah, I just think there's like a pulse, and you have to follow the pulse, and you have to feel the pulse, and that the subject needs to be in every paragraph somehow. And so I think it was that, like if I'm going somewhere and then suddenly the pulse is has gone away, you know, then go back, right? And so kind of trust your instincts in that way.
So, of course, we're bumping up against time because Keith Herring was the man, and you are a terrific biographer of Keith Herring and his work and his place in the world. But you tell a story, and this is not a spoiler, but you tell a really charming story as we leave the book about Keith Herring and your own family. And you have a couple of kids now. I'm not entirely sure how old they are, but...
5 and 9 right now.
Oh, 5 and 9. Oh, so they're tiny. Okay. I'm going to ask you to sort of explain how Herring is a member of your family. And it comes through this book, obviously, but it's a really nice note to end this episode of the show on.
Well, I think when I was thinking about what to do, I was very aware of, at that time, had younger children. I mean, one was 2. So the other not here. But we would go around every night and say goodnight to the art. That was something we did. And then, and Walter would point always at the Keith Herring. And I think it was the color red. But, you know, I was also realized I'm going to do this some kind of project. It's going to go on for a while. And is there a way for it also to be available to them? You know, and I just realized the Keith kid connection in some way really worked. So, I mean, in that way, I always think Walter sort of inspired this book. He pointed me to Keith Herring, and he is very much a part of his life. And now both kids are in elementary school. They, not only do you see kids wearing Keith Herring, but in the classroom across from Walter's, on the wall in the hall was a whole like hallway length page of kids drawing Keith Herring, learning how to draw, right, from these Keith Herring drawings. So you just realize that he's definitely enduring. I mean, talk about a next generation.
It's a really, really lovely story. Brad Gooch, thank you so much. Radiant, The Life and Line of Keith Herring, is out now. And if you're a Frank O'Hara fan, please just go get City Poet. It's just, it's terrific. Thanks so much, Brad.
Thank you. This is a great conversation. It was great.
Thank you for listening. Poured Over is a Barnes & Noble production. To help other readers find us, please rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts.